order, and we'll open the public hearing on House. On the House Bill 2217. Not everyone is ready, so we're going to carry that over till next Monday morning, and we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2986. Janet, can you give us an explanation of the bill, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2986 would delete a requirement that physicians and health care workers report to the Department of Transportation impairments affecting a person's ability to safely drive. It would make such reporting discretionary. It would also provide that if a physician or health care worker does not make a report, the person is immune from civil liability that might otherwise result from not making the report. Under current law, the physician and health care worker is has civil immunity if they do make a report, if they make such a report in good faith. And this would, again, make the reporting discretionary and provide civil immunity if they do not make a report, as well as if they do. Specifies that the reports to the department are for information purposes only, and that the department is responsible for the determination of likely effect on a person's ability to drive. That's the case today, but it clarifies that situation that it, again, is the department's determination. Specifies that reports are confidential, may not be used as evidence in civil or criminal action, but may be used for administrative hearings or appeals regarding the person's qualifications to drive. Mr. Chair, there's quite a bit of history on this bill and the work on this particular issue, and the Department of Transportation is here to give that background.
Thank you, Janet. Could I have Lorna Young, please?
Before I forget to do this, there were two pieces of testimony that were submitted in writing, one from Wayne Schumacher, the Oregon Optometric Physicians Association, and from Rob Bentley, Oregon Academy of Ophthalmology, and those are at your place today. They are in support of the measure.
I would just point out that they request our support of HBO. To 2986. So I guess that's home box office. I'm not sure.
Thank you for pointing that out.
That's useless information you really didn't need, is it?
Good morning, Lorna.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Lorna Young's administrator of the DMV. And I appreciate the opportunity to come before you. As I recall, when I gave you kind of the overview of the DMV in January, which seems an awful long time ago for all of us, you did ask us to come back and give a report about our progress in implementing this bill, so implementing the older driver or the risk driver program. So with this bill, I think that gives us a really good opportunity to bring you up to date of where we are and also to discuss the concerns that of the medical community regarding the bill. I've given you a packet that briefly goes through kind of the history of how we got to where we are. And as you see on the first page, that we have that classic U-shaped curve, which shows why we are concerned about the older driver. They drive fewer miles, that is true. But per mile driven, older drivers are more likely to be involved in crashes. They have a similar profile as teen drivers. For different reasons, of course, older drivers are more prone to simply the aging process, which makes it more difficult to respond to changes in the environment as you drive, and also physically makes driving more difficult. So just as we had the teen driver bill to deal with the young driver in the 1999 session, there was a bill introduced to deal with older drivers, and that bill was simply a bill requiring us to test everyone after a certain age. And that was not determined to be a reasonable approach because it felt that it just unfairly penalized people at a certain age. And so we were sent off to form a group to study the issue, which we did in the interim, assembled a group of experts that involved the medical community, representatives of senior organizations and various service providers for associations that dealt with disabled and people with medical impairments. We held a number of statewide meetings and came up with a rather extensive set of recommendations, which we then presented to the legislature in 2000. It was in a broad, sweeping set of recommendations, including education, outreach. But one of the key pieces of that set of recommendations was the fact that Oregon's mandatory reporting program only reported one condition, loss of consciousness. And it was a recognition that far more than loss of consciousness affected the ability to drive. We're really talking about ailments that affect your ability to hang on to the steering wheel, to properly control the car with your feet, to be able to turn your body so that you can see what's going on around you, to be able to react in time to the many changes in traffic that occur. When you think about when you drive, there's so many things that you do almost automatically. You're not even thinking about it. But if you have impairments in terms of your ability to react quickly, physical impairments that keep you from being able to steer, to hold the wheel, to control the pedals, then those are the kinds of impairments that this advisory group said we ought to be taking a look at those as well instead of just loss of consciousness. So that in year 2001, House Bill 3071 was passed, and that bill extended or broadened the requirement for mandatory reporting, and it gave the Department of Transportation the authority to set in rule what the impairments would be and which members of the medical community would be required to report. And we were given some resources through the Emergency Board to fund a coordinator for the position and assistance in setting up the program. So we went to work with the medical community to try and figure out how could we come up with a set of rules that would help guide physicians on how to report. Because the important thing, critical point that the law made is that the determination cannot be based solely on the diagnosis of the medical condition. The fact that you've been diagnosed with Alzheimer's doesn't mean you're automatically reported. It must be based on the actual effect of whatever medical condition you have. And that effect has to be so severe as to substantially interfere with your ability to drive a car. So that meant we had to go to a lot of work with the medical community to figure out what were those kinds of conditions that you could link up to driving. And also we knew that there would be a great deal of concern about the liability that physicians would face for the reporting. And there were similar sort of concerns when we started mandatory reporting of gunshot wounds and mandatory reporting of child abuse. What would happen to the physician if they made the report? And so the law specifically designated that a physician or a health care provider who makes a report to the department in good faith would be immune from civil liability for making that report. And further, the medical information contained in the report would be determined to be held confidential. So these were two additional provisions to help safeguard the physician from the reporting process. Now, the bill that you see before you today has some additional concerns about, and that is about what happens if you don't make that report. The medical group, working group that we put together to work with on the bill and contain representatives from the OMA, the state health officer, plus a number of medical specialists that helped us determine the cognitive and functional impairments that we needed to address in order to determine which ones affected the driving behavior. And we also looked at which health care providers should report. At the same time, we recognized that we also needed to put together a public education consortium because there needed to be a companion piece, and that was one of the many recommendations from the advisory group, that you can't simply reduce, restrict, or take away a person's license and not provide some community support for that individual to be able to carry on their functions in life, because driving is such an important part of our ability to be independent. And so we also are looking at and are working on developing an outreach piece that speaks to community support, self-regulation, as well as self-diagnosis, ways in which you can work with family members, healthcare providers, social services, transit communities, to take a look at ways in which additional support can be given to individuals who are at that point where they're no longer able to drive because of a physical or cognitive impairment. On the next page, you see a list of the various kinds of functional or physical and cognitive impairments that we looked at. Obviously, vision is pretty straightforward. Vision and field of visual acuity and field of vision. Strength, and strength's important in terms of being ability to grip the wheel, to use foot controls, to be able to appropriately use all of the various controls in cars, even though it doesn't require much strength anymore to be able to steer with power steering. You also have to have enough strength to sit upright, not to fall over when you make a turn. And that can happen with individuals who have some severe loss of motor control. Peripheral sensation. Do you have numbness in your hands and feet that makes it difficult for you to actually control and touch and feel the pedals? Flexibility and range of motion. Can you turn your body? Can you see what's going on around you? And also, obviously, motor planning and coordination, which really speaks to reaction time. And whether or not you have problems with dizziness or you have involuntary muscle twitches that make you jerk the wheel. And with today's power steering, just the slightest turn of the wheel gets you out of your lane or maybe into the curb. All of these things we are determined affect your ability to maintain lane control and to react to the traffic around you. Then on the cognitive side, we took a look at issues related to attention, awareness, being able to constantly read the traffic around you. Judgment and problem solving. When you see something, are you taking the appropriate action? When a car is coming at you, are you avoiding it? When the red light's in front of you, are you stopping in time? Planning and sequencing, all of these relate to the ability primarily to make the right decision when you get that information. You go to make a left-hand turn. All of a sudden, there's a car there. Do you keep making that left-hand turn or do you stop? Those are the kinds of issues that occur as people begin to lose their cognitive abilities. We've set the program up essentially to have two types of reports, mandatory reports and voluntary reports. Now, a mandatory report is only required of physicians and healthcare providers when the impairment is severe, uncontrollable, and not correctable by medication, therapy, surgery, driving device, or technique. So really only at the end stages of. So if, for example, you are diagnosed with Alzheimer's, you're not reportable at that point. But if your Alzheimer's advances to the point where you are completely lost when you go outside, you don't know where you are, you don't remember how to manage a car, you don't remember what you do, that's the stage in which an individual would be reported. The doctor sends the form in, sends in a report to us, which gives us what is the type of impairment that's being reported. How is the person affected by that impairment? And what our rules do is help the doctors and the medical community look at what are the specific kinds of impairments and how they relate to your ability to drive. An example would be, as I said before, if you had a peripheral sensation in extremities, a loss of feeling in your extremities, that would affect your ability to grasp, manipulate, or operate, release the primary, secondary driving controls, inability to stop in time, difficulty gripping the wheel, and then therefore difficulty in being able to maintain the lane, and difficulty in using foot control. So we've laid out in our rules how each one of these physical or cognitive impairments would affect the ability to drive. So the doctor reports how the impairment affects the individual and it gives us information about what that underlying medical diagnosis is. And if we determine that there is sufficient evidence that the condition that this individual has meets that criteria of being severe, uncontrollable, then we will send out an immediate 5-day suspension notice to that individual. At that point, the driver can decide that they really are no longer able to drive, voluntarily give up driving, and we will give them a free ID card. As you know, you need identity to be able to operate in today's society. Or the driver can decide that they don't agree and request that they be retested. If the individual has a functional impairment, physical impairment, then we will schedule them for retesting, and they will go through our written test, our vision test, and the driving test. And if they pass all those tests, then we will restore their license. If, on the other hand, they have a cognitive impairment, we will send their case, their information, to the state health officer for a review to determine whether or not that the particular individual's case is so advanced that it's not really safe for them to be taking the tests, the driving test in particular, because we're also looking at air safety and our drive examiner safety getting in the car with these individuals. If the state health officer agrees that they should be retested, then we will go through the retesting process. If they pass, then they will be, their license will be restored. If they fail, they have the opportunity, if for some reason their condition improves, to go ahead and retest with us and get their license restored. And then, of course, they also do have the Administrative Procedures Act process available to them as well to ask for administrative hearing on this. Now, for those individuals the doctor is not sure really meet the mandatory requirement, they can send a voluntary report into the DMV in which they explain to us why they think this individual may have a problem, may require testing. We'll take a look at that report and determine, is there sufficient information to go to the immediate suspension, or is there, and communicate back with the doctor if there isn't, if they haven't filled out all the information out. And if we determine that there is not sufficient evidence that this person represents an immediate endangerment to themselves and others if they drive, then what we will do, we'll send them a notice asking them to come in and test within 30 days to determine whether they still have an ability to drive. Then it goes through the same process. If they pass all the tests, they are able to retain the license. If they don't pass the test, then we will suspend until such time as they can stabilize whatever they have in the way of a condition and pass the tests. Now, we recognize that as we put this program together, there would be a lot of concerns. And we did do a public opinion survey a year or so ago to determine who did the public have confidence in making a determination of who should be licensed or not in relationship to medical conditions. And overwhelmingly, the public said it should be doctors, not the DMV, making this call, which is why we need this close partnership with the medical community, and which is the, you know, basis of the recommendation for the mandatory reporting program. And we have worked closely with American Medical Association in developing these rules, but we also know the world has moved on, and there are new opportunities for tort liability, and there is a growing concern about the fact that doctors may find themselves liable for a failure to report, just as much the law has given them a protection for if they do report. But what if they don't report, an individual does get involved in an accident where there's a loss of life or injury, are the doctors now liable? And so that is what this particular bill addresses. So the policy question I think before you today is whether or not a voluntary program would be adequate or not to really get the kind of reporting we feel we need to deal with the issue of the older driver. But we are certainly willing to work and have been working with the American Medical Association to see if there are ways that this current law can be strengthened in terms of more protection for liability, short of turning it into an entirely voluntary program to help deal with their concerns. And with that, I would be more than happy to answer any questions you may have.
Is there any questions?
I just have one question. How do you deal with a disorder that's not imminent at the time of a driver's test? I mean, I know, for example, physicians need to report seizure disorder. And if somebody has, say, epilepsy, mm-hmm. testing them is not going to make a difference because they're not likely to be having a seizure at the time they're going to be tested. It's the probability of the seizure that's at issue. Were there other disorders other than seizure disorder that you came at in that discussion?
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlick, There, that certainly is an issue that we'll be wrestling with, and part of the partnership that we have with the state health office is to deal with conditions which are where an individual may require what we call medical certification. In other words, they're not deprived of their driving privilege, but they are monitored, and they need to go back on a regular basis. And because many of these conditions are controlled by medication, and so as long as you're on your medication, and you can continue to drive, but you do need to be monitored. So one of the additional pieces to the program, which has been in place already for the loss of consciousness part of it and will continue to be in place, is that some individuals may be required to retest or be under a certification program that requires them to periodically revisit a physician and ascertain that where their condition lies.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to get a sense of the magnitude of this issue, problem, and I know that you've only had this program in place, at least this particular program, for a couple of years, but can you give us a sense as to how many people get referred to the to DMV for retesting? I don't know if you have those numbers.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dingfelder, I don't have right now how many people have been tested or have been referred mm-hmm. to the DMV for just the loss of consciousness. One of the things that we don't know, because we haven't implemented this program that expands it to this range of the conditions, is what we will experience. Certainly, it's in the thousands per year for loss of consciousness, which is the reason which I forgot to mention why we are going to be phasing this program in, and taking it slowly so that we learn and the physician community learns how to operate under this program. So our rules have just been heard. The hearing closed on the 12th of March. We had. And our intention, once we get the comments back and make the changes to the rules, and many of the changes it looks like that we'll probably be making are to address many of the issues that have been brought forward by the ophthalmologist in relationship to some of the items that were in our rule. But our intention is to begin in six counties only, Lane County South, Lane, Douglas, Coos, Curry, Jackson, Josephine. We'll be training and working with the medical community there and work in that arena for about, I believe, a three-month period to see what kind of problems we run into in terms of over- or under-reporting. And, of course, the big concern would be over-reporting, false positives, where individuals are reported as having problems, get a suspension, and only to be found upon testing no longer don't really need it. So we've hired a nurse to work with us to help understand do a better job of reading the reports as they come in, work back with the physician community. So we intend to spend at least a full year gradually phasing this in over the state and making changes to the rules as they are needed if it turns out that our approach is too comprehensive or does not work well with the physician community.
Just one follow-up. Sure. I guess the question I have is, looking at this bill, is could these changes be made through rulemaking versus, I mean, I heard you say that you're working with the physician mm-hmm. community, so I guess I wonder if it's too early to tell yet. I mean, I'm looking at the thing, we haven't implemented this program yet.
Right.
And we're already making changes. So I'm trying to understand if there could be some way through the rulemaking process that we go back and revisit. Based on that, I mean, I'd sort of like to see how successful the program is and what the issues are before we go and change it, is my opinion.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dingfelder, we have consulted with our attorney, and in fact, the Attorney General, his representative, is here in the audience in case you would like to question her. But the ability to grant physicians immunity for not reporting is beyond the scope of rulemaking, and that particular piece. Other, we have proposed some alternatives, but our Attorney General has told us that we cannot grant that in rule, and then that's the piece that this legislation does.
Thank you.
Representative Greenlight.
You also couldn't make it voluntary, rather compulsory.
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlee, no, we could not do that by rule either. So that really is a policy decision for the legislature.
Thank you.
Representative's honor.
So nobody really has done any reporting, theoretically, under that the bill that was passed before.
Mr. Chair, Representative Zahner, no, we have not yet implemented it. We intend to begin to implement this about the first part of June. It'll take us that long to get through all of the finalization of the rules.
In the original bill, was it mandatory?
Yes, sir.
Follow-up? So how do we, now we want to make it involve, we don't want to make it mandatory, we want to make it voluntary, but we haven't done it the first way, so we don't know if it doesn't work the way we passed the bill.
Mr. Chair, Representative Zahner, it is not the DMV's intention to make it voluntary. We are explaining our understanding of what this bill does and what the OMA is interested in doing, but the DMV is still in support of the recommendations of the task force that was put together on older drivers, that the reporting should be mandatory.
One final follow-up.
Your
gut feeling, if we make it voluntary, will anybody report at all?
Mr. Chair, Representative Zahner, I really don't know, because I don't believe that making it voluntary will relieve physicians of the potential tort liability for suit for failure to report if one of their patients gets into an accident, because we've already seen a similar sort of suit. Now, the suit did not prevail, but I think... And the DMV is certainly not immune to that sort of suit, and we will continue to be party of those sorts of suits, regardless of whether it's voluntary or mandatory.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Breyer.
Thank you. I had a conversation and had gotten a letter from an associates in my district, and I'm sure that the tort issue probably is important to them, but their issue is the patient and not seeking treatment out of concerns. Now, did you say that you have dealt with some of the concerns by the optometrists, or that you're looking at them, or?
Mr. Chair, Representative Beyer, yes. We have received a lot of comments that from the optometry associations that they feel that our rules have gone too far in terms of the types of eye conditions that should be reported, and that is certainly something we will be addressing in the revisions to the rule. We are very sensitive to the issue of the relationship between doctor patient, and I guess it, as I say, it's similar to other earlier reporting requirements where the doctor has to weigh the total health of the patient and their likelihood of getting involved in an accident if you don't report them. So that's why we want to work very closely with the physician community in training to say that you should only report at the end stage of conditions where that individual truly is an endangerment to themselves and their fellow drivers, if they're out, in which case you are performing a service for them. And I don't know how many times people have come to the DMV and said, I can't get Dad to drop the keys. Would you take the keys away?
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Remember that.
It's a terrible situation.
It's a horrible situation. Lorna, I had a constituent, I think it was about a year ago, called me. He lived up by Eddyville, a young man, I believe he was in his 40s. For whatever reason, he had a fainting spell. Mm-hmm. His wife called the ambulance. They hauled him into Corvallis and could never find any cause for it. But his driver's license was suspended. Was that under this program then?
Mr. Chair, that was under the original loss of consciousness reporting program. And one of the things that we have done is, of course, we've, in the course of expanding this program, we've also overhauled the entire medical reporting program. So we will be getting more information for loss of consciousness. And one of the things that I particularly want to be sensitive to is where an individual does have an immediate suspension, making sure that they have an opportunity to get testing, to get that resolved as quickly as possible, if it is just an episode and not something that is uncontrollable. So we've actually turned this into a... for the rest of the state, they will be under the loss of consciousness reporting requirement until this expands to their portion of the state. But in the part of the state where we're working, and loss of consciousness is worked into as one of the many conditions that would be reported.
And then I had another constituent that lived in Walport. That was an older gentleman, I believe he was 85 years old, called me, and he was very, very upset. He had received a notification in the mail from DMV to come in to do some evaluations and tests, and he was very proud of his stint that he had spent in the Marine Corps, and you could but justifiably so, and you could tell that he was a fiercely independent person, and I didn't know which direction to turn to try to do any help, and I did call Kelly Taylor, and mm-hmm. I learned then that you don't have access to those files, but also I understand that about 9 times out of 10 those are family members that are encouraging the individual to be tested, he doesn't. In this case, this person apparently didn't realize that it was a daughter that lived in the Willamette Valley that thought maybe Dad shouldn't be driving any longer.
Unfortunately, that is the voluntary side of the program where you called in for testing, and we do we are put in that position of serving to be the one that does what the others aren't quite ready to do. And we recognize that even in Portland, without a car, without driving, it is it's difficult to continue life as you've known it.
Thank you. Any more questions, Lorna? Is there anyone from the medical community that would...
thank you very much.
Thank you, Lorna. Tim?
Sit next to me. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, Tim Martinez here on behalf of the Oregon Medical Association. We do appreciate you having this hearing today on this bill. I would tell you right up front that this is not the final product of the bill. It was one we introduced early in the session to get a vehicle in play. We're very pleased to report that we continue to work with the DMV to try to see if there isn't some middle ground here. I certainly heard through the tone of the questions from Representative Zahner and others that we have in front of us a bill that hasn't even been implemented from the previous session. I would tell you, however, having spent 5 days in this very room already this session looking at malpractice insurance costs and liability costs in the state of Oregon and elsewhere, that liability is a huge issue, and this bill or this new program raises a lot of liability questions for us. The chairman raised some good issues talking about his constituents. I can't tell you the number of times, because this is now my second tour of duty with the Oregon Medical Association, the number of times where I've had members, lobbyists, and just folks in the building, staff in the building, come up and say, you've got to help me do something about grandpa or grandma or, great aunt or great uncle. The medical community, I can't remember, one member of the committee talked about, would this be reported if not for the bill? I would tell you absolutely. I would encourage all of you, if you have a moment, on the floor or elsewhere, to visit with Dr. Bates. Dr. Bates tells me that he probably twice a month reports folks to the DMV. He lets the patient know he's going to do that. He tells them they're free to seek other medical provider if they don't like that, but that in his opinion they shouldn't be driving, and he does that voluntarily, and he believes he is not unique in that. So physicians around the state are already doing that. I mean, I think we need to remember that physicians are there to help, not hurt. So I think that occurs now. The not seeking treatment is also a big issue. You know, if you have somebody, whether it's an ophthalmologist or anything else, if they choose not to seek treatment because they're concerned that their physician is then going to have to report them, that's going to be an issue. We all see seniors in the building. We know they're very active politically, and once rumors start spreading through their community, it's very, very hard to turn that around. Even as Young's talked about, you know, kind of the false positives in this way, where, you know, you may think somebody needs to be reported and is reported, and it turns out the DMV decides not to take any action, that can dramatically impact the doctor-patient relationship. And then lastly, I would just say she did talk about reporting gunshot wounds, and I guess I would suggest, I'm not a physician, I freely admit that, but it's probably a little easier to tell whether somebody's been shot than it is to decide whether or not they ought to be driving a car. Now, having said all that, Grant Higginson is sitting next to me. He has a dual role. He's a little nervous, but Dr. Higginson is on the OMA Legislative Committee. He has been very involved in this process since day one. I know he'd be pleased to answer any questions you may have specifically, and I'd be happy to try to answer any questions as well.
Thank you, Tim. Grant, please go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Dr. Grant Higginson. I'm the state public health officer, and as Tim says, I'm a little schizophrenic up here today because I also have this other role in sitting on the OMA legislative committee as well. And just a little background on my involvement in this whole issue. Since I've been state health officer, and that's been for 8 years now, I am responsible for the medical certification program. So as Ms. Young stated, when there are questions about a person's medical condition possibly affecting their ability to drive, those cases do come to review by contract physicians that we have under our employment, who then make a recommendation to DMV, and then DMV makes the determination on whether or not they can drive. And in the past and currently, there has always been a mandatory piece and a voluntary piece. Right now, the only mandatory piece is for up until when this new program is being implemented, the only mandatory piece is loss of consciousness that may become or is chronic. Other than that, though, there's the voluntary side of things where not only physicians can report, but anyone can report on the voluntary side of things. So even if physicians aren't reporting voluntarily, we still are going to get a number of reports either through family members, through the police if they see a driver that they think is possibly medically compromised, that will continue. I also was involved in at least keeping touch with the at-risk drivers study prior to the passage of the legislation in 1999. I was also on the committee that looked at the 1999 legislation and tried to craft the new rules, and that was not an easy process. I repeatedly heard physicians say, you know, we do not want to be the DMV police. We're going to have some problems recognizing those cases that really do need to be mandatorily reported. So it has been an issue that has not been an easy one to take from the conceptual, philosophical, legislative mandate to the actual process, and as always, you know, the devil really is in the detail. And then for the last several months, I've been on the OMA Legislative Committee, where this is one of the issues that we've discussed, and the medical community still does have a number of concerns about this. From my perspective, and actually I think I'm now speaking from both hats I'm wearing today, is that I do think that there needs to be a mandatory program. I think that there does need to be something, and the legislature has said it needs to be based on functional or cognitive issues rather than diagnosis. But I do think that there are some cases that any reasonable practicing physician would be able to see and say, this person should not be driving. A person who is totally blind, regardless of correction, I mean, any physician should be able to say, that person should not be driving. Similarly, a person, as Representative Greenlick brought up, with seizures that are uncontrollable despite aggressive therapy. I mean, that person is at risk for loss of consciousness at any time. That person should not be driving. And again, that's another one that I think that can be reported. But those, I believe, are really a fairly limited case, and that we also, in a number of cases, and that what we also need to do is rely on a voluntary program where we are encouraging physicians, other healthcare providers, and other people to report individuals who they feel are at risk for driving, and if there is a medical issue involved, then those are the people who should be run through the medical certification program where we talk with the attending physicians to help make that determination. At that point, it wouldn't be the attending physician that is making the mandatory report and causing the suspension. It really would be a process that involves not only a health care provider, but the state's public health officer's office and the DMV in making that final determination. And so I think what I'm hearing from both DMV and from Tim Martinez is that we need some more time to work on this to see how much we can figure out prior to taking a serious look on what we should do with this bill, and I would be supportive of that as well.
Thank you, Grant. Representative Greenland.
Thank you, sir. I certainly support waiting a bit as well. But, Tim, there are two issues here, and it really would be good to separate. And one is the voluntariness issue, and the other is a liability issue. And I certainly hope as we work through future iterations of this bill or things that come out of it, we try and keep those separate, because I understand the worry about liability. It's enough of a problem as we're facing now. But there are lots of instances where physicians have to report and have the potential for affecting the physician-patient relationship. STD is a perfect example, but we've just decided decades or even centuries ago that sometimes there is this balance between the individual life of the patient and the public health needs, how other people are affected. And I would just like to, do you think it is possible to separate those issues so that we try and deal with inappropriate or unnecessary burdens on the liability side as a separate issue from the question of the voluntary versus
Mr. Chairman, Representative Greenwood, yeah, I think that's definitely, definitely possible. There is, as you know, with your background, there's always that pull among the medical community to be there for their patients, or from time to time be there for the betterment of society, as far as reporting some of the things you talked about and others. In some of those instances, there are clear liability protections put in place to protect healthcare providers when they do report. I have had a couple of brief conversations with Dr. Higginson on this kind of blended program where you would develop some kind of a master list that would be mandatory and then have also a voluntary component. And we do need to sit down with the DMV and see if we can come up with agreement on a program like that. Because as they just testified to, in order to make parts of it voluntary, you do need to change the law.
Representative Mabry.
I guess what's running through my mind, and I don't know that there's an answer to, but I give you the opportunity, and that is it would seem to me the conditions that make it mandatory to report are the ones that, if we didn't have the mandatory, are the ones that would be reported voluntarily anyway. And the issues that would become voluntary wouldn't be reported because they're not severe enough or there's not enough certainty, so we end up with a voluntary thing that would be mandatory. I'm not making this very clear, am I? We end up with a list of things that we mandate be reported, but if we took away that mandate, they'd quite likely be reported anyway. Does that make any kind of sense in the question?
To me, no.
Not to you?
Can we record you?
You've done a good job. Either one of you gentlemen can take a stab at that.
I guess what I'm saying.
Thank you. I guess what I'm saying is making it mandatory or not really isn't going to have a great deal of influence on what is reported. Because I don't think the list that is non-mandatory probably would be reported anyway. And so then I don't see the difficulty in saying, you got to report these things. I would almost think it would be refreshing for a physician to have to say, gee, Mrs. Mabry, I don't want to have to be able to do this, but I'm required to by law. And, I'm just as sorry as I can be. That seems to me to make more sense.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mabry, up until now there has been both the mandatory and the voluntary. What would be changing on the mandatory is that rather than having the chronic loss of consciousness be the only mandatory condition, there now would be a number of mandatory conditions, right, based on function rather than diagnosis, function and cognitive ability rather than diagnosis. And to me, like I say, I agree. I think that makes sense and that we can define that in such a way that reasonably practicing physicians should be able to do that. There are, I think, many more cases, though, where it's the same functional or cognitive problem that the physician is not going to be able to say, yeah, this is severe and uncontrollable to such a degree that person should not be driving. But we still want those people to be reported to a system where they would be evaluated and take it off the physician's responsibility to mandatorily report, but to be able, as Tim was saying, Representative Bates does, to tell the patient, I have severe questions about and concerns over your ability to drive, and so I'm putting you into the system where you're going to be evaluated. And so I think in addition to that mandatory piece, which I see as a pretty small piece, I think that we also want to be encouraging voluntary reporting, because from my read of the law really was to expand the number of people who were being evaluated to try to keep the roads as safe as possible.
And Mr. Chairman, Representative Mayor, if I could take a second shot at that as well.
Clarification would help.
I think one thing you have to remember is, this law applies to more than just physicians, but just looking at the physician community, everything from ER docs to OBs to urologists, you just can go through the litany to surgeons on down the line. And what I think we're looking for is a carrot rather than a stick. If you say, if you're a physician and you say these in any patient that you see, then you have to report this. But with your Dr. Bates, who obviously has a family practice, and others who see patients on a regular basis, they ought to have a little more discretion on what they report and don't report. I guess we look at it as trying to see if we can't turn this into a little bit of a carrot approach rather than a stick approach.
Any other questions? Representative Gilman?
Mr. Chair, I have some questions, but I'm suffering the same problem that Representative Mabry is. I'm not
You're
sure I can
in trouble. I can blend
I'm not sure I can formulate them. First of all, giving me an idea of how much paperwork we're talking about by all of this determination of whether it's voluntary or mandatory, and when I look through this list of functional and cognitive, I have a lot of respect for doctors, but I still think that's asking a lot, and I'd like you to address that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gilman, In regards to the paperwork and DMV really would have a better answer than I do. What we see in our portion of the program is that we get referred to us from DMV a form that's called a certificate for medical eligibility that has information, and it's actually just a one-pager, information about the patient, some information about the attending physician, what the diagnosis or condition was, and then if the physician puts any recommendation on what they think about the driving ability. And then attached to that would be information on the driving record of the person over the last several years. And then possibly there would be other additional medical information that would be attached to that as well. In most of the cases, just from looking at that one form, our contract physicians are able to get back to DMV with a recommendation. In about 10% of the cases, they have to go back to the attending physician or other health care provider, gather a little more information, usually over the phone, sometimes through the mail, to get that information before they make a recommendation. On the DMV side, I'm just not sure how much more additional paperwork there is than that. But from our side, it's not overly burdensome. In regard to the question about whether or not it's difficult for physicians to be making these determinations, particularly when they're not based on diagnosis, but instead on these functional and cognitive criteria, that I can say, you know, was one of the main issues that was talked about in the work group that was trying to implement or trying to help with the development of these rules, is how can you do that, and how can you know for certainty that this is severe and uncontrollable, and that's a difficult thing, and I continued to raise that issue myself. And that's why I think that if we are going to have a mandatory program, the mandatory piece of it has to be this limited piece where it's pretty clear that these things are the kind of things that you should be reporting, and the rest of it, I think, is going to have to be discretionary in this voluntary program. And I do agree with Tim on this, that if that's the way we want this to run, and if we do want to get all those people that may be a hazard to driving due to medical conditions, that there does have to be some kind of incentive to get them to report those cases as well.
Thank you. I Representative Gilman, I think Lorna was holding up the form back there. Lorna, can we have a copy of that?
Oh, good.
Is there any other question? Representative Gilman.
Mr. Chair, regarding the immunity, it says a designated physician or health care provider. How about a neighbor? What if a neighbor sees his guy driving in and finally the guy starts running over garbage cans and hitting the house? And Could he get on the immunity bit too and protect him for reporting, or would he? Could you open it up a little bit?
Mr. Chair, Representative Zahner, we hold confidential any report that comes in on a voluntary basis. So if the individual wants to know who reports them, we won't tell them. But there's not a specific part of this statute, the original statute, that addressed immunity for individuals who voluntarily reported. The statute only represented, dealt with individuals who only dealt with physicians or medical providers who were required to mandatorily report.
Okay.
And if I could address Representative Gilman, so we have worked very hard because we recognize physicians are very busy and they need something very straightforward. So what we have is a simple one-page form. On the front of the form is a list of the and I'll pass it around for you to take a look at, is a list of the various cognitive and functional impairments. But on the back side of the form is a guide to each one. So, for example, strength, as I pointed out before, is a list of the kinds of things that we're looking for. Inability to consistently maintain firm grip on objects. So if you're in your, say, neurologist's office and he's doing standard tests because you think you might have something like muscular dystrophy or whatever, and you're doing your standard tests and you can't hang on to things and you can't push against his hand and you can't maintain even your balance when you're walking. These are the kinds of things that we've laid out on the back of the form as a guide to the physician so that they can simply check the boxes on the front after they've read the back to say, yeah, these are all the things I see. And that's why I feel confident that I can check this box. And then there's a place below where they can describe the particular condition and how they see it relating to us, and I'll be happy to provide that to you.
Any other questions? Like that's it. And Tim, there'll be some amendments coming.
Mr. Chairman, hopefully.
Yeah, okay. So we'll be revisiting this issue. Right? Yeah, Janet says when.
We'll wait for next.
Didn't we work on this last
Thank
time?
You.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for your testimony.
I drove up the hill on the way to my house with a man at the wheel, and his wife was leaning over. She was steering.
I will close the public hearing on 2986. And we're going to jump out of order here a little bit and open a public hearing on House Bill 3522. I think they're going to get Janet to bring us up to date on the bill.
Remember all those lists.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Because I made the comment.
House Bill 3522 directs the Department of Transportation to adopt rules covering restrictions and requirements on the distribution of use of monies from the Elderly and Disabled Special Transportation Fund. It specifies that monies received from the fund be distributed and used consistent with rules and, of course, statutes rules adopted by the department and the statutes that govern those rules. Mr. Chair, there's some background written in the staff measure summary, if you want to look at that, and the Department of Transportation, as well as the requester of the bill is here.
Okay, thank you, Janet. Representative Johnson, please.
Betsy's here again.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. With your permission, I'd like to be joined here by Martin Loring from the ODOT Transit section.
Certainly. Morning, Martin.
Good morning, Chair Brown.
Martin and I are going to do this as a tag team, but by way of introduction, let me start. I'm Betsy Johnson. I'm the state representative from House District 31. What we're trying to fix with this bill is essentially an accountability element in the application of transit money at the local level. This is essentially a best business practices bill. We had a situation in Columbia County where the county contracts with a not-for-profit to provide transportation services. And while generally this flow through of federal money to ODOT to local providers has worked well, there are instances where ODOT may need to exert some additional control over the application of funds. And that's what this bill is designed to do. It's to simply provide ODOT with a few more options with respect to the disbursement of federal funds and make sure that money is being spent appropriately and legally. And I'll now defer to Mr. Loring, and then we can answer questions together.
Thank you, Representative. Martin, go ahead.
Chair Brown, committee members and staff, my name is Martin Loring. I'm the administrator of the Public Transit Division within the Oregon Department of Transportation. Thank you for the opportunity to be here today. House Bill 3522 directs the Oregon Department of Transportation to adopt rules for the distribution and use of monies for the Elderly and Disabled Special Transportation Fund program. This program has existed since the mid-80s. It's the major source of state funding to support badly needed transportation benefiting elderly and disabled Oregonians. We work through governing bodies. Those governing bodies include 24 boards of county commissioners, each serving the county they're responsible for, and 8 districts, transportation districts or mass transit districts, serving the other 12 Oregon counties. So 33 governing bodies, 36 counties. This system, I believe, has worked very well. We're delivering some 5.5 million rides a year for elderly and disabled residents who need this assistance. I can remember a former governor who had a favorite phrase that talked about, if something's not broken, why fix it? I don't think things are broken in the Special Transportation Fund, or at least not badly broken, but this bill is about stewardship of public funds. During the last session of the legislature, the Ways and Means Committee essentially asked us to sharpen our pencil and do a better job of stewardship in making sure that dollars were efficiently and effectively spent, and that all the dollars appropriated by this body to serve the elderly and disabled achieved the statutory purpose of the underlying law. That seemed like a pretty good idea. And we took direction, assembled a committee to look at rules, and early in the process visited with someone in the General Counsel Division of the Department of Justice, who told us that under the current law, as good an idea as that sounds, we do not have the legal authority to do anything along those lines. That in the current statute, there's a requirement that there be at least a 3-person advisory committee, and that is the only enforceable provision of the current law. So there haven't been any horror stories to write home about, but if there were, the Department of Transportation and my division charged to administer this thing would have no oversight authority, no course of action that we could legally take to rectify things. That's the bad news. The good news is the counties do a good job, the districts do a good job for the most part, but what this bill would achieve, and I commend Representative Johnson for proposing to improve state oversight, state accountability, state stewardship, and that's what this bill would do. It would command the commission to write some additional rules. In that process, we would work with stakeholders, we would work with counties, we would work with districts, we would work with area agencies on aging to come up with the right set of rules that would that maximize local flexibility, allow them to continue doing the very good job they're doing, keep the decisions at the local level to the maximum extent practical, but give us that ultimate hammer that if we ever do see a case, and I hope we don't, where funds aren't being used as the legislature intended them to be used, we'd have some recourse, some action to haul people back into line.
I think that Mr. Loring has summed this up quite well. The impetus for this bill came from a situation in my district that brought into very clear focus the fact that ODOT needed some additional tools. I want to put emphasis on the point, because I know I'm looking at a lot of folks with local government experience. I want to put emphasis on the point that this is, I think, an assist to local government rather than any kind of usurpation of local government authority. It's a way for ODOT and local government to partner in making sure, for the benefit of the people of Oregon, and particularly for those elderly and disabled who depend on these transportation systems for their medical transport, their socialization, their day-to-day living activities, that the money is there, that the money is spent appropriately, and that we are stretching each dollar to its maximum efficiency and effectiveness. And with that, we'd be happy to answer any questions.
And so this is to prevent that once the money gets to the county level, that there may be the opportunity for it to be used and for other things than what it was intended for? So.
That appeared to be an issue in the Columbia County scenario. We had a situation in Columbia County where the county contracts with a private not-for-profit to provide senior and disabled services. And as the money was flowing through the county, it began to become clear that the very well-intentioned not-for-profit, who was run largely by a board of seniors, was out of compliance with federal drug and alcohol. And we needed to go to the state, and the state and the county together have the tools to say, first of all, we need to have assurance from the not-for-profit that the money is being applied into the senior and disabled transportation program. It's not being diverted to pay other costs of a struggling not-for-profit. And secondly, that compliance issues are dealt with by the not-for-profit. And I think sometimes in the growing body of compliance issues with the federal government, particularly dealing with technical areas like alcohol and drug testing to make sure that the bus drivers are safe, that sometimes the complexity of those regulations exceed the capabilities of a local board. And as well-meaning and as well-motivated as they are, sometimes they maybe need a little bit of guidance to make sure that they're in complete compliance and that the money is being spent appropriately. When the situation became manifest in Columbia County, the state was unable to give any real guidance absent the corrections that we're asking for in this particular proposed piece of legislation.
No, I understand. Thank you. Any other questions? Representative Joyner.
Betsy, anybody opposed to it, other than maybe that nonprofit?
Representative Brown, Mr. Chair, and Representative Zahner, there is at this moment no known opposition that I'm aware of. However, we stand completely prepared to work both with the agency and with anyone that has any suggestions that would make the bill better. I wouldn't be surprised to hear some objection from the not-for-profit in Columbia County. Frankly, they're under a great deal of pressure right now from both DHS and ODOT to implement some governance improvement measures, and there has been some local resistance to that.
Well put. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any other questions? Thank you, Representative. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Committee.
Could I have Mary Lou Ritter, please?
Good morning.
Good morning.
Committee Chair, committee members. My name is Mary Lou Ritter. I am an Agency on Aging and Disability Director in Washington County, but I'm really here more in my capacity as an advocate for elderly and disabled transportation. I have worked with the DMV Older Driver Study Group. I've also been on the ODOT Public Transit Advisory Committee and was pretty aggressive in having you work with us to get more general fund for elderly and disabled transportation a few years ago, and we are still expressing our gratitude for your support in that effort. This bill, I don't believe, as you heard from Martin Loring and the representative, has any opposition. I'm not here to oppose the bill. I am a big believer in stewardship and public accountability, and I think this bill would afford some tools. I want to really make the point that this funding, the senior and disabled transportation funding, or elderly and disabled transportation funding, is a critical funding for the network of seniors and people with disability in our state. And we want you to have confidence that this money will be distributed and administered appropriately, because we don't want you to have any kind of concern about refunding elderly and disabled transportation. Now, I know that part of the overarching budget considerations that are before you now is that the cigarette tax money that goes into this STF, Special Transportation Fund, has been withheld or is on the list to be withheld to fund trips for people in our community. And I want to, that cigarette tax is a part of this STF program. So to the extent that you have confidence that we're going to administer your money well, that's important. And to the extent that I can encourage you not to take away the cigarette tax funding for elderly and disabled transportation, I would like to do that today as well. In the Tri-County area, which we've been working in, Clackamas, Multnomah, and Washington County, through this STF money, we've been able to find the additional money that you've provided us has been able to provide 500,000 rides to over 5,000 new people in our community. So it has made a very big difference, and we have been very diligent in making sure that the funds are spent appropriately. We've even been able to leverage volunteer rides to augment the paid rides in this system. We've also been able to train people with disabilities and seniors on how to use public transit so that we can use the lowest cost mode of travel and empower people to greater independence. So I want to say that governance and stewardship are important to all of us as advocates, and this bill in particular, I think, will provide some tools for assuring that, and that we want to continue to press you to fund the programs for elderly and disabled transportation. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mary Lou. Just this last week, this committee passed a bill and sent to Ways and Means that would that identified some revenues from the ID card fund, and our bill would request that that be used for elderly and disabled transportation.
Yes, my gratitude and our gratitude for that. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Is there any other questions? You have one? No? Looks
thank
like
you. Right
now. Thank you very much. Roger Martin, you showed up late, didn't Roger? Did you have any? All right, thank you very much. With that, we'll close the public hearing and open the work session on House Bill, lost track of the bill, 3522.
Mr. Chair, I would move House Bill. Okay. I would move House Bill 3522 with a due pass recommendation to Ways and Means.
Representative Beyer moves that House Bill 3522 to the be approved and sent to the Ways and Means. Lost track. Where is that? Is there any discussion? Hearing none, Ryan, you call the roll, please.
Representative Mabry.
Aye.
Representative Zahner.
Aye.
Representative Beyer.
Aye.
Representative Dingfelder.
Aye.
Representative Gilman. Aye.
Representative Greenlink.
Aye.
Chair Brown.
Aye. Motion carries.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Johnson.
Unless that's who would like to carry it, I'd like
it's
to put on the
consent.
It's going to Ways and Means. Yeah.
Forget it.
Okay, we won't do that. Let's see, we got...
Keep me on the straight and narrow, Dan Keller. Don't let me wander off the reservation.
We'll open the work session on House Bill 3001. Janet, can you refresh our memories?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This bill was heard March 19th. The original bill would extend the sunset on the doubling fines in two safety corridors. The Department of Transportation has had the authority to post the doubling of fine in safety corridors. And when they post it, doubles the base fine amount on a traffic ticket for certain violations. You had at that meeting the Dash 1 amendments, and that the only thing those do is add the emergency clause. So they would, the Dash 1 amendments and the original bill are on 8-year sunsets, extending it out to 2008. Excuse me, not an 8-year sunset, but 2008 would be the sunset date now if the bill passes. And the Dash 3 amendments are from your discussion at the last meeting, because the Dash 1 amendments keep the two safety corridors, and it was discussed at the meeting that those would still be up to the Department of Transportation, which two, if they want to differ from the two that are already designated for doubling fines. The Dash 3 amendments, after your discussion, you talked about wanting to consider at this meeting letting the department pick any of the 13 safety corridors, not to limit them to two safety corridors if they want to have additional pilots. And if you look at the Dash 3 amendments, the change is in line 8, where the word 2 is merely taken out. That's the change in the Dash 3s. The Dash 3s do also have an emergency clause, so you really have a choice between the Dash 1s and the Dash 3s today if you're going to go forward with this bill.
Mr. Chair, may I ask Janet a question on this?
Certainly.
Janet, I was wondering whether in line 12, whether the effect of this amendment by taking 2 out of line 8 and leaving the A at the end of line 12 might restrict this to a single corridor. I mean, I wonder whether that A at the end of line 12 shouldn't be any.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Dan?
No, I don't believe, Mr. Chair, that would be read that way, because this is the way that you're looking at current law, and they can do 2 today.
But we're taking out the 2. Oh, I see. It says in 2 committed in a safety corps.
It's just saying that a safety corps chosen by the department, and up above you give them the ability to do any safety corridor.
Is Troy here? Yeah.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I think that's right. I think when you take them both into consideration.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman.
Good morning, Troy. Then if we adopted this, then, Troy, the department would have the ability then to make any and all of the safety corridors double fine. Is that right?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Troy Costales, manager of the Transportation Safety Division for the Oregon Department of Transportation. The Dash 3 amendments would give us the option to choose and potentially have all 13 of the current corridors signed and identified as double fine, not just limiting it to the current 2. The Dash 1 amendments would indicate 2, but then also would leave it up to the department to pick which 2 for the next 5 years time period that the extended sunset date indicates.
Do you have some sort of idea what kind of a criteria you'd use to double the fine in a corner?
Mr. Chairman, we don't have anything in writing that would indicate which ones we would try and look at double fines. However, every one of the safety corridors today has a plan that involves judicial, law enforcement, the community, looks at the crash information in order to say what do we need to do in that safety corridor to make an improvement. We would add in a conversation with that group around that corridor around double fines. Is this something that the courts and law enforcement would support, the community in the area would support in order to move forward with the conversation? We wouldn't want to put the signs up without getting the impact of people involved and understanding what we're working on.
Under this statute, then, and with this amendment, would you be able to, one that was an existing corridor with double fines, could you change that then?
Mr. Chairman, my understanding is on the dash one as well as the dash three, it's not requiring the current two that are double fine to stay as double fine because it's discretionary to the department as to, you know, zero all the way up to two in the dash one or zero all the way up to 13 in the dash three.
Any questions? Representative Beyer,
I don't know whether I should ask you. I don't know whether it makes any difference. By allowing you this option, does this possibly get us to a revenue impact or a...
Mr. Chairman and Representative Beyer, the potential fiscal impact on this, if we were to look at the remaining 11 and just pick a normal one out of the 11 to say we're going to sign it, by putting the signs on the front end of the corridor, the end of the corridor, for both directions, and then we would sign all of the major entrances into the corridor so that anybody going onto the highway knows they're getting into a double fine zone, would be about $15,000 at the high end if there are a lot of entrances like there is on 26, for instance. There's a lot of side roads that are signed. Some of the corridors may be less just because there aren't as many major roads that connect in the corridors. It is sign budget, and where would that revenue come from to pay for the sign would either be from within already the highway division sign allotment or potentially the safety division. We would reorient some of our grant funds to pay towards highway to have those signs placed. But because it's discretionary, there's no fiscal impact to you for Ways and Means because it's not mandating that we do all 13.
Can you give us some sort of idea? Do you have any thoughts about how many more of these you would do or not?
Mr. Chairman, I don't off the top of my head as to how many we would add. I believe that we would try and anticipate having a conversation on two or three in particular right out of the gate if this bill was to pass, and because there are some active communities around the safety corridors, those are going to be easier for us to approach the whole community and say this is an option we can now add. And I imagine what will happen is the groups that are associated with the other corridors, once they hear this is an option, they'll probably, you know, knock on our door or give us a call saying can we do this as well. It's going to be in part, is the community willing to get engaged? As Senator Metzger had pointed out when he testified originally on the bill, there was some confusion and concern about how courts were treating the double fines. Mm-hmm. And one of the things we don't want to do is all of a sudden have it where law enforcement says they're wanting it and business is wanting it and community wants it and courts say, why do I have to do this? You're sending a mixed message to the people in the corridor. So we would have to look at the ones that are active and have people engaged and willing to move forward, and then hopefully we would see the other groups follow suit. Given there's a five-year window, it also allows us the time to be able to do this. You just can't go out and put those signs up and get everybody engaged overnight. It takes a little bit of work to get it going.
Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you, Troy.
Thank you, sir. And I would also point out Representative Zahner and a few others had asked questions about the current corridors and their current stats. We have a report for you, and we'll leave with Janet so that you can have access to that later on this morning, give you an idea of where the corridors are and what their current records are for the 13 that exist today, based on the last hearing on the bill.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, committee, what is the, our wishes?
I move dash three amendments to 3001.
Representative Greenlech moves the dash three amendments to 3001. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? If none, they're adopted.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3001 with the dash three amendments. It doesn't have to go to Ways and Means, is that correct?
That's correct. There was no.
I move with a due pass recommendation to the floor.
Representative Dingfelder moves House Bill 3001 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Mr. Chair, do we have to adopt the dash ones as well?
No, I think the dash ones are in the dash three. Any more discussion? Hearing none, Ryan, will you call the roll, please?
Representative Zahner.
Aye.
Representative Beyer.
Aye.
Representative Dingfelder.
Aye.
Representative Gilman.
Aye.
Representative Greenlech.
Aye.
Representative Mabry.
Aye.
Mr. Brown.
Aye. Motion carries. We need a carrier.
I'd be happy to carry.
Representative Greenlech will be the carrier. Janet, do we have anything else?
No, Mr.
Chair. Oh, okay. At the backlog of bills that we are getting, if people get their amendments and get their act together so we can start running them, Janet and I have been talking about the possibility of moving our meetings up to 8 o'clock in the morning and possibly even having an afternoon hearing if we can work it around everybody's schedule with the large complex.
The committee I sit with at 3 each day.
At 3 each day. But just a thought in the state members.
8 o'clock would be great, and, you know, if we cut down some of the testimony on some of these,
a lot of them we've already had hearings on. We're just sitting there waiting. Sounds like everybody's nodding their head and they're happy to come at any time in the morning.
Name it, we'll be here.
Anything else?
Are we going to meet Monday morning at 8 o'clock or what?
Not yet. Not. We'll let you know.
Oh, I'm ready.
Oh, and there's no meeting Friday. Yeah, that's right. Friday. You going to be here, Cliff?
No, it's Monday.
Here.
That's what I said.
Oh, okay.
We're going to meet at 8 o'clock Monday morning.
Okay.
We're
meeting 8:30
Monday. You have you posted the... Okay, why don't we say 8 o'clock Monday then?
8 o'clock Monday?
He just said 8 o'clock Monday.
Wait a minute.
Is it going to be a problem?
Has it been posted?
No.
I thought I received an agenda, right? Monday, yeah.
8 o'clock.
8 o'clock from Portland.
Oh.
So I might get your
8:15.
That's it. So we can pass good bills. Quit
ride
before
your
you
bike
get
up here.
I'm going to start riding my bike. So
don't ride your bike.
I go the speed limit, Mr. Chair. So I go the speed limit,
okay,
Mr. Chair.
Why don't we? We'll let you know.
But okay,
we'll
thank you.
We'll let you know tomorrow.
Well, we could be at 8, and then we don't vote on anything until she gets here.
It's only some of us get the speed limit.
We are here.